Welcome, everybody, to Podcasting Them Softly, episode number 5. I'm here with Nick, co-host and co-founder of Podcasting Them Softly. And I can't even believe that this is our 5th episode already, right?
Yeah, I was just saying in my head that hello, obviously, and can't believe that this is the 5th week. So, pretty exciting.
It's insane. And I've really been looking forward to this episode because we're going to be discussing Mark Pellington's I Melt With You, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And I don't know how many read my review or thoughts of the film, but I essentially have 2 top 5 lists, which I think most people do that are serious about watching film. You have like your group of your favorite films, and then you have your group of the best films you've seen. And for me, I Melt With You is in both of my top 5 lists. I absolutely love it. And we are also going to be discussing the top 5 performances of Rob Lowe and Carla Gugino, who are both featured in I Melt With You. We'll also briefly discuss the Vanity Fair, the next issue of Vanity Fair, where Annie Leibovitz photographs behind the scenes and gives us the images of the characters of the new Star Wars film, The Force Awakens, which gets me incredibly excited. I know I shared the shit out of everything I saw on Facebook, and I know Nick also saw that as well. So we will segue into The Force Awakens. What were your initial thoughts when you saw it? Just give me your initial thoughts of the Vanity Fair cover.
I think that all of it so far looks, you know, like how what you'd sort of expect it to look from J.J. Abrams and, you know, what he sort of promised people in the media about what his intentions were with the new movie. You know, he's stressing practical stuff and he's stressing an old school feel, and the pictures certainly gave that off. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, without a doubt. I love the fact that Abrams talked about how important it was to use practical effects like the original trilogy and use CGI when needed, and how he also talked about the references that he kept in to the new film that referenced the original trilogy and how they took a lot of the references out because they didn't want to overdo it and they wanted this film to stand on its own feet. Even though it's a continuation of the Star Wars canon saga, I think is really neat.
Yeah, but it is important for it to be its own thing. So I agree. I saw the piece you're talking about, how he said he had to kind of cut back on, like you said, the references. But yeah, you can just tell from the second trailer that was released, even more so than the first. You could just tell that the outer space stuff looks just very similar to the way that the outer space stuff looked in the original trilogy, which got me very excited because I wasn't a huge fan at all, really, of the prequels, which we've talked about.
Hater.
So I am looking forward to this one with a heck of a lot more excitement than I did the second or third prequel after Phantom Menace again.
Yeah, I won't disagree with you there. I love the fact that they're continuing the story from Return of the Jedi and the fact that Lawrence Kasdan gets brought on.
Yes, that's a huge
as
plus.
The screenwriter. Yeah, I was out to dinner with my mother tonight to take her out for Mother's Day, and she was talking to me about the movie, and she's like, aren't you worried or concerned that George Lucas doesn't have any part in this? And I told her, at first I was, but the fact that they brought in Lawrence Kasdan, no. And J.J. Abrams, I think these two guys are going to knock it out of the park, hopefully, with The Force Awakens. And as far as the photographs that were shown of the actors that are playing the characters, I liked the Adam Driver photograph. I think most of us knew that Adam Driver was going to play the new lightsaber-wielding bad guy, but it was cool to see him with the mask off just to let us know the character he was playing. It'll be interesting to see if he has makeup on or if his face if his face is CGI'd or anything like that. It'll be interesting to see what they do with his voice and face for the film, because I imagine that his mask is going to stay on probably the entire film. I don't think he'll be unmasked. I mean, the photograph they shown, he had his mask off because it was a photo for Vanity Fair, but it'll be interesting to see. I like Adam Driver a lot, and I'm very glad that he kind of has this career that he is going with now. I liked him ever since I saw him in the first season of Girls. I thought the guy was incredibly interesting. And then what? He got the part in Lincoln, and then I know film you like.
Yeah, he's excellent in Tracks. I don't know if you saw Tracks.
I didn't, but he's in Francis Ha. Is he in film that
you
saw?
Yeah, and I was just about to say, he was in if he was in Francis Ha, I don't remember him. That movie felt like an episode of Girls anyways, really. He's in While We're Young, and he's excellent.
Right.
And he's excellent in it. I think he's an excellent actor. I find him very quirky talent. I was very surprised when I heard that he was cast as a villain in Star Wars. I thought that was really cool. He's very unique looking. He's a very interesting looking guy. So I agree. I'm curious to see what they'll do with a mask or whatnot. I didn't realize that he was playing a villain that was going to have a mask. So I've actually sort of stayed away from, other than watching the trailers, of course, I've stayed away from a lot of the articles and a lot of the written stuff and a lot of the stills and a lot of the other things, because I just sort of want to see the movie with, in this day and age, there's just so much hype and there's just so much stuff that gets leaked before a movie, like with, you know, with something
right.
like Mad Max, there's a zillion trailers and I feel compelled to watch all of them because it looks so insane. But there's still a side of me that, you know, still wants to have a little bit of surprise. And I think that with Star Wars, especially with how I felt about the prequels, I think the less I know about this new movie going in, the more fun I'm going to have if I'm not going in with a certain set of expectations because I've looked at every picture and read every article.
Right. The only thing I'm going to look at is the stuff like Vanity Fair and the trailers and the posters. I haven't sought out any message boards or any websites for potential spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I do think is interesting with the Vanity Fair shoot, and I know this is going to be next month's issue, I believe, and they're supposed to release a few more images throughout the month, but they've saved Max von Sydow, and they haven't shown him in any of the trailers, and they haven't even shown him in the cover, or I should say in the Vanity Fair photo shoot, and I think whoever he's going to play, it's going to be big.
Well, yeah,
because
you know,
you don't cast Max von Sydow
exactly.
to be just some generic character or a character that isn't going to hold a lot of weight. So I was really excited when I read that he got cast in the film.
Absolutely, yeah. It should be very interesting to see, you know, obviously how it all comes together. And I'm very excited to see it on a visual level. I think that if JJ isn't, you know, bullshitting everybody, which I can't imagine he is, it'll be very exciting to see a movie on the big screen in 2015 that somewhat approximates, you know, the look and feel of, you know, those other, the original trilogy, which will be exciting, you know. And I don't want to digress too much, but that was one of the big things I had. I'm guessing that you, I don't know how much you like the Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
I hated it.
You hated it, yeah. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. I'm somewhere in between on it. It's too much nostalgia for me to hate it. But one of the things...
It just wasn't an Indiana Jones movie. I know it had Harrison Ford in it, and it had Karen Allen,
and it was done by
Spielberg.
Yep.
But it was just...
It didn't look at all like the other movies. It didn't look.
No.
It didn't look and feel like it. Like Douglas Slocum's cinematography, especially in the I'm trying to remember in the Crusade, is some of the best action movie cinematography ever. And there was no real attempt made by Janusz Kaminski, as great of a cinematographer as he is. There was no real attempt to approximate the look and feel of the other movies to sort of aesthetically tie it in. And you know, given that this is the Star Wars Episode 7, you know, has the, in my opinion, the benefit of having to not really pay much attention to the prequels. It feels like Abrams has gone out of his way to aesthetically link his movie up to, you know, the end of Return of the Jedi. So, and one can only when one can only hope for some Ewoks. So,
dude, the Ewoks have to be in it. I don't care. I don't care if it's just like a brief little scene. The Ewoks have to be in it.
How
will
they not?
The Ewoks.
They're going to make all these standalone movies, right? They're going to do a Boba Fett movie, right?
Right. The first one's Rogue One with Felicity Jones, where it takes place a few years before A New Hope, and it is a band of rebels that are stealing the Death Star plans.
Wait a minute. That movie takes place a few years before A New Hope.
Yes.
So it's a prequel to A New Hope, but it's after Sith.
Yeah, it takes place somewhere in between, but closer towards A New Hope, because it's about a band of rebels that are stealing the Death Star plans that, you know, the rebels get and blow up the Death Star in A New
Jones,
Hope.
I'm a big fan.
Her and Ben Mendelsohn are the two that have gotten announced thus far that are going to be in it, which is...
Somehow I missed the fact that my favorite current actors, Ben Mendelsohn, has been cast. Are you kidding? He's in the new Star Wars movie?
Yeah, he's going to be in Rogue One. They haven't announced who anybody's going to play. I'm assuming that Felicity Jones is the leader of the rebels, the rebel commandos that are stealing it. I hope that Ben Mendelsohn plays an Imperial or plays Peter Cushing's character from A New Hope or something. I don't care who he plays, to be honest with you.
There better be a scene of him like sweating and like smoking a cigarette and like looking unshaven and like dirty and hungover,
smoking some Star Wars era cigarette, yeah. Right? And then the second standalone it hasn't been officially announced, but it's pretty much known that it's going to be a Boba Fett film.
That's the one that the Godzilla guy is doing, right?
The Godzilla guy's doing Rogue One, the one with Felicity Jones and Ben Mendelsohn.
Oh.
The Josh, whoever the guy that did Fantastic Four, he just dropped out
directing
the Boba Fett film. But I believe that Lawrence Kasdan is writing it.
Do you know who they should get?
Because they should get Lawrence Kasdan to direct it.
Lawrence Kasdan or Joe Johnston?
Yeah. That would be excellent.
How are they not getting Joe Johnston on the phone after making the fucking Rocketeer, excuse the French? How are they not? He did a bang-up job with the first Captain America. And
yes, he did.
Let's not forget how much charm. I mean, I don't know if you were a fan. I love the Rocketeer. I saw that.
Of course I love the Rocketeer.
Okay, I'm not sure. You know, it wasn't.
Fucking Timothy Dalton. As Errol Flynn, the Nazi Errol Flynn.
I loved it. It's great. Notoriously not a huge hit in the theater and critically, you know, muted response. So you never know.
Billy Campbell power.
Trust me. I agree. I love that film. So let's get somebody somehow to get a note over to the people doing these movies. Joe Johnston should be up for that job. I think that he would do a great job with a Boba Fett movie. I mean, are you kidding? Didn't Joe Johnston create Boba Fett? Didn't I mean, like, I could be wrong, and I'm not a Star Wars aficionado, but you could look it up. I have
Lawrence,
somewhere in the
Lawrence movie. Kasdan did.
Lawrence Kasdan created the character?
Well, Lawrence Kasdan wrote Empire Strikes Back.
There's somewhere, it's got to be noted that Joe Johnston had something to do with Boba Fett. In any event, he would be a good director for the film. But yeah, it's going to be exciting to see the new Star Wars movies. If they get these good filmmakers, you know, on board to, you know, carry these films out, who knows what could happen. It could be very interesting.
Right. I think I like the fact that Disney's doing it after they did Marvel movies. Because I think they're able to learn what works and what doesn't work. Plus, Star Wars holds a lot more weight than Marvel films. Because Marvel films was something new, and Star Wars is a staple in cinema. And I know that you have some disdain towards the prequels, but looking at it objectively, Star Wars, the reason the prequels didn't kill the Star Wars name is because Star Wars is too big.
You know
what I mean by that?
Well, yeah. As much as I didn't enjoy the prequels, it never stopped me from loving the original trilogy. You know, which I went out and bought, and I've watched. You know, since, you know, not enjoying the other one. So I agree completely. Star Wars is an un, Star Wars is an unstoppable force in the landscape of cinema. I mean, it's just, you know, people who don't like science fiction go see Star Wars. I mean, it's just,
right.
It's just, you know, you can't not see Star Wars and be American, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. So, wrapping up the Star Wars, love it. We both love the... I'm buying the Vanity Fair next month. Of course I am. I can't wait. I'll probably frame it, actually, the cover. I liked it that much.
I will say I'm getting more excited for the movie as it gets closer and closer.
Oh, for sure. Another thing Nick and I both did this week is we both got the new 4K remastered anniversary edition of Goodfellas on Blu-ray. And
yes.
I watched it twice, 2.5 times, actually. I don't know how many times you watched it.
I watched about an hour of selected scenes a few nights ago. And just beautiful. I mean, it's just, you know, it's my number one movie of all time. It has been for years. It'll likely never change. And seeing it that cleaned up, but still looking
right.
like a film.
Still looking like a film,
like,
right?
You know, they didn't overly process it. It still had that great look, you know, that early 90s, you know, celluloid feel. And, you know, I have to watch the documentary. I can't wait to see that, but it just goes without saying, it's just one scene after another of priceless moments, and it's just, like I said, for me, it's my favorite movie of all time. I mean, I could talk about it for hours and hours and hours. I've seen it so much, and watching it all like that again, cleaned up, not that I had a particularly huge problem, and I'm not the greatest with judging how things look versus, you know, old versions, but I had to double dip, or in this case, quadruple dip, because, you know, I don't know how many versions of Goodfellas I own. It's insane.
I've owned every release, from VHS to the first DVD that you had to flip over.
Yep, I had that one.
Watch.
I had that one, too.
You had to flip it over during, it was before Billy Batts gets killed, right? Isn't that where you had to flip the DVD over?
Yes.
I want to say?
Yes.
And then I've owned it on Blu-ray. And now I've owned it on Blu-ray. I think I've owned like 5 copies of it, actually. This is my 5th copy, and it'll probably not be the last because they'll release... Because I believe 4K Blu-rays are coming out soon, so we're fucked. That's pretty much what it comes down to.
Time to get into TV. Don't tell the wife yet.
Right. Thankfully, I did get a 4K TV, so I'm good there. I'll just have to buy a 4K player.
Well,
your poor wife.
Let's have you get into the film at hand tonight, because it's a difficult beast, and it's gonna require some good sussing out. So why don't you start off? Because I know how much it means to you personally.
Mark Pellington's "I Melt with You" came out in 2011, and I'm going to start with this. I am a man. Now I remember. I am divorced. I can't get hard. I love my wife. I don't love her. I lie to myself. My mother is dead. I'm rich. I'm a failure. We forget. I am the breadwinner. I am married. She left me. I'm under 50. I'm just like my father. I'm nothing like him. I'm over 21. I can fuck. My kids need me. I'm losing my hair. I need glasses. I am afraid. I love you. I melt with you. So right off the bat, before you see anything in the film, before you see the title, I Melt With You, you get these text flashes of everything that I just read, and it is fast, and it is hard. All of those 3 or 4 word lines pop up on the screen, and it all builds to the title shot of I Melt With You. In a nutshell, or what you would read on the back of a DVD, on the back of the Blu-ray, or on IMDb, the brief plot synopsis is 4 friends get together once a year, and they have ever since college, and they spend the entire weekend partying. And these are all middle-aged men. They're all 44. They all graduated college together, and they met in college together. It's a small cast led by Thomas Jane, who plays Richard, the quote-unquote failed writer who becomes an English teacher in high school. Jonathan, played by Rob Lowe, who is the general practitioner that turned into selling prescriptions to his wealthy patients and selling out. Jeremy Piven, who plays Ron, who is a fraudulent investment banker. And then Christian McKay, who plays Tim, who is an artist that lost his partner in a crash that he caused, a car crash that he caused. A lot of this film is ambiguous with a lot of things. I shouldn't say a lot of things. It's ambiguous with some things, but then it just completely gets in your face hard and fast. And the first act of the film is the four of them getting together. They're partying. They're doing all sorts of drugs. And I don't mean smoking marijuana and stuff like that. They are taking hard prescription pills that Rob Lowe supplies them with. They're listening to loud music. And they spend the first act of the film reminiscing and partying and bringing women over that they met at the local bar because they're renting this beautiful house on Big Sur on the ocean. And the first act of the film's fun. It's laugh out loud funny. What, don't you think? When you rewatched it, I was laughing out loud at a lot of the stuff of the four friends reminiscing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It has that you know, exciting in the moment, you know, feeling of being with guys, you know, friends who are, you know, catching up and reminiscing and partying hard and doing all sorts of drugs and, you know, getting off and having a blast. So yeah, it's a unique film because it takes a very interesting you know, leap in the second half. This movie doesn't necessarily feel like a three act film. It kind of feels like a two act movie in a way. And for me, it almost felt like a play at times because you were so confined to the house. I felt like this story, you know, in some ways maybe even could be transferred to the stage, because it offers such great opportunity for the actors. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I agree with you. The second act of the film takes a completely dark leap that when I watched this for the first time, I couldn't believe it happened. And from that point on, it continues to trek into pitch black territory that you think it's going to happen, but because it's a movie, you're watching this all unravel and you can't believe it. And it just keeps going and going and going until it's over. And it's an abrupt ending. Mm-hmm. And this movie knocked me on my ass when I first saw it. I remember seeing the trailer for it because I don't remember how I saw the trailer, but I like Thomas Jane. I like Rob Lowe. I like the director, Mark Pellington, a lot. I think I saw the trailer, and I was just like, holy fuck, I have to see this movie. And because it premiered at Sundance, and because everybody hates this film, it went straight to VOD, so I was able to see it that way. I remember renting it, and I was in my bedroom, and I was watching this, and I couldn't even believe it. This film, to me, in a way, is I double-checked on Rotten Tomatoes. It has a 12% on Rotten Tomatoes. Everybody hates this movie.
That's just criminal. Like, it's just... I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but I just want to say one thing about Rotten Tomatoes. As nice as it is as a source for finding critical notices about movies, I really can't stand how everybody, and I say everybody, the mass population... how they must look at that as some sort of barometer of what great filmmaking is. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's all good. What I was going to say is I'm Out With You is a classic example of people stockpiling on a film saying how terrible it is. It's one of those films that comes out that everybody hates and everybody just continues to hate it. And they pile on and pile on. It's very Heaven's Gate in a way where Heaven's Gate killed Cimino's career, much like Pellington's career in a way. And it was killed before the movie even got a release, much like I Melt With You. But now we look at Heaven's Gate as an epic film, and it is. I mean, Criterion Collection released it. I've watched it. I love it. I think Heaven's Gate's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I Melt With You will turn into this, but maybe one day it will.
It's destined to find. It's destined to find another life, because the great thing about cinema these days, you know, and I'm all for watching movies on the big screen or on the biggest television that you have at your disposal. But for a lot of people, they're watching movies on computers, on laptops, on phones, on what have you these days. And just the fact that there will be plenty of people who will find this movie somehow, and it will hit them in a way. You know it will happen. It's a movie that is too. It's a movie that is too provocative to leave someone without feeling something visceral and intense. Love it or hate it, you know. It's a movie.
Right. There's no in between with this film. I would love to meet the person that would watch this and be like, "Oh, it was okay." It's either. And I think the reason, and we've spoken about this, I think you and I both like this film. I love it. I mean, I can't say enough about it. You know that about me. We look at this film in two different ways, I believe, in a way. You love the – we both love the aesthetics of this film,
yes.
The coloring, the cinematography, which you have a lot to say about. And I love that too. That goes without saying. But what's important to this film for me is you have a group of these four guys that have reached a point in their life where their life didn't turn out the way they all thought it would when they were young idealists. And I think that's something that everyone can relate to and identify with. Not saying that people's lives don't turn out that way. Some people's do, not everyone's. And these men have reached a point in their life where they're closer to the end than they are from the beginning of it, and from who they were and from who they hold on to inside of themselves. And this film is about the male psyche and the dark parts of it. Fear, greed, shame, self-hatred is all represented in these characters who are all broken. Tragically broken in an incredibly and pure, beautiful way. And I don't mean to sound morbid by that, but it's truly this soul-bearing film. And I think the issue with this film is Mark Pellington is essentially, for this film, he's holding a mirror up in front of your face. And what you're seeing in the reflection of this film is aspects of your life that are uncomfortable. That's, for lack of a better word, that are uncomfortable. I mean, it's showing you things that you lie to others about, and particularly that you lie to yourself.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, I think I'm more in touch with a lot of stuff that gets brought up in this film. Speaking for me personally, when I watch the film, I can identify with the fear and the loss and the shame and the self-hatred, and more so than I think most people who can watch this film and it makes them feel uncomfortable. You know, it's a tough film because
you're forced to identify with these. You're forced to personally get involved in this movie. And it's not – you can't watch this film passively. The passive
– Right. I think it's more than being forced to being engaged with it. I think you find an emotional connection with what's happening on screen, particularly with, you know, Thomas Jane and particularly with Rob Lowe. They're the two main characters. Thomas Jane's the leader of the pack. Rob Lowe's the follower and supporter of Thomas Jane. Piven is the cynic that essentially finds his way with the rest of them. And Christian McKay is the broken philosopher of the group. But I particularly think that Rob Lowe's character is the most tragic of them in a way. As the doctor who becomes this smarmy piece of shit that sells prescriptions and then supplies his friends with drugs for the weekend. But there's also this dimension of Rob Lowe's character who is dealing with the loss of his wife and child. And I don't mean death. I mean the fact that they left him and there was someone else and his wife is remarried and Rob Lowe's son calls the stepfather daddy. And I think Rob Lowe's character identifies himself as a father and that's who he is, and that gets stripped from him. And he's also dealing with the fact that the one that he loves is no longer in love with him. And I think that's happened to most people. And I think those people who that has happened to, you watch this and you can't help but feel yourself inside of Rob Lowe. That's my take on his character.
Yeah. And to that, to your point, you know, I find myself getting involved with these characters while never sort of bonding with them. I can't say that I relate to some of the things that are discussed, but then again, there are aspects certainly of each character that I could relate to. As you said, it's a movie that will force the viewer to look at themselves through the prism of these people. And some people won't like what they see. And other people are going to have a tough time with the on-screen drug use. There's just no question about that. In fact, I have I didn't even say to you offline, a coworker, I was talking about this film. And while the coworker, the guy I was talking to, while he appreciated the acting and the conviction of the film, the drug use for him was just too much. It made him nervous. It made him, it just was too much for him. This is definitely on the level of The Wolf of Wall Street, The Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the rampant consumption of substances, which leads to characters acting and behaving and saying things that people who are abusing drugs would, you know, do or say. They're oftentimes in movies, guys, you know, somebody smokes a joint or does a couple lines, and then, you know, 2 seconds later, they're like, you know, nothing is going on. And that's not the case in this film. These guys go on an epic bender, and they, you know, you see it. You see it for the whole, I mean, Thomas Jane is spun out by the time the movie is coming to its conclusion. So this movie really does have a conviction in really every department, from all of the performances to Pellington's direction, which is overwhelming at times by design. And again, I think that even when there will be, you know, even when presented with aspects of this film that you might not immediately relate to, I think that there is so much of this movie, and really illustrated by the text that you read off at the beginning of our discussion. This movie opens with a startling beginning sequence where all of those bits there that you read off are printed on screen, and it really sets the tone right off the bat that you're dealing with a movie that is introspective and as existential. Something that's going to look at the problems that these guys are facing in a very intense way, never letting anybody off the hook. And I don't know how much we want to delve into the second half of the film, which again, you know, the first half is sort of a raucous party, which is, you know, sort of quote unquote all fun and games. But I guess the trailer, you know, does indicate where the story goes, so I guess it's not spoiling anything to say that one of the four friends ends up committing suicide. And after that moment, it triggers something in the remaining three men. And maybe, I guess, we'll stop short of discussing any further quote-unquote spoilers or plot developments. But let's just maybe leave it that that the death of the first friend has a tragic, toll on the rest of the group. And
without a doubt.
And that would happen in any group of friends who are that close. And they made the point through the use of pictures and through the use of, you know, quick flashbacks and their conversations, that this is a group of friends that met in college and who made the point of keeping in touch for 20 years. A lot of times you meet people, they, you know, you're friends for a while, you go your separate ways and, you know, that's that. And you don't really reconnect. You know, this has the, you know, the aspect of The Big Chill, but sort of,
right.
You know, on a much darker, much more, you know, emotionally upsetting realm.
Right. It's as if it's The Big Chill, but just with four characters that are all William Hurt's character from The Big Chill.
Exactly.
I mean, and to bring up your point of drug use and comparing it to The Wolf of Wall Street and Fear and Loathing, I think that's spot on. And I think what sets this film apart from particularly The Wolf of Wall Street is this does not glamorize drug use at all. It may at the beginning when they're doing cocaine and popping pills, and Sasha Grey is in it briefly, is this girl who comes over with a bunch of other people while they're all partying, and it's like, oh, we're doing drugs and hanging out with hot 20-some-year-olds, and, you know, but once the film takes the dark turn with the suicide and the drug use gets bigger and bigger and it progresses further and further, this is definitely a de-glamorization of drug use, as to where Wolf of Wall Street, I remember seeing it in the theater with my buddies, and as soon as the film was over, it was just like, dude, it's just a shame they don't make Quaaludes anymore. You know what I mean? Because, like,
yeah.
you're watching it, and you're like, oh, my God. All I could think about the whole next day was, like, I wonder what a Quaalude's like.
Yeah, exactly.
I would try it if somebody put it in front of me. But with I Melt With You, it's just – it's startling.
Yeah,
and
it's the desperation that comes with that sort of drug abuse and – you know, I guess this sort of ties into my most, you know, as we've discussed before, visual aspect of storytelling is of paramount importance for me. This is a film is a visual medium, obviously. I'm all for cinema being told in as visual way as possible. I don't necessarily need, you know, a garrulous screenplay to consider the work amazing. If a director or a filmmaker can get across images and, you know, get across ideas and emotion through pictures, I'm all for it. This movie is overwhelmingly gorgeous. It has a visual quality and clarity that I haven't really encountered, except for maybe some of Terrence Malick's works. And I had a lot of visual correlations between The Tree of Life and Enter the Void with this movie, between the use of color, the vivid color that's used. What I thought was so funny, and you could tell right off the bat, right in the beginning of the film, that there was something special going on with the palette and with the aesthetic. The colorist is given an on-screen credit up front. I have watched, I don't know how many movies in my life, I have never seen The Colorist getting a credit, and it's much deserved. This movie, because I call it sort of a two-act film, the visual structure is very seamless from both acts, but the presentation of the visual language sort of changes a little bit, especially when we open up outside of that house in the second act, and you get some absolutely crushingly beautiful images of Big Sur and the ocean,
right?
Which work to really counterbalance the loneliness and the desperation of these characters. And that was one of the things I liked so much, is that you know, Pellington and the writer Porter, was Glenn Porter is his name, I think.
Yeah.
They chose to set this film where they did, and the use of space and the use of the ominous nature of the house being perched on that cliff, and everything about this movie feels exactly the way that I could see them wanting to make it. Which is challenging in this day and age of cookie cutter, just the idea that everybody wants to see the same thing over and over again. Well, this movie is not going to be that. So,
right, you took the words right out of my mouth when you said ominous, because that's exactly what the exterior as well as the interior of the film is, with the fog and the mist, and it's almost shot as if it's this thriller horror film in a way, with isolation and desperation and the horror of what's happening to these people, and the choices that they've made in the past reflect the actions that are seeing presently, that we're seeing presently in the film. When I rewatched this probably a couple, it was a doozy of a week. I watched I'm Out With You probably three times, I know, right? I sound like I'm suicidal. I'm not. I promise everybody is listening. But, I just because I hadn't seen it in a while and I wanted to speak about it in depth because I feel like this is a film that deserves this sort of treatment. But while watching it and you're perfectly right about it being shot in Big Sur and the house is on a cliff and there's water everywhere and, you know, there's not a lot of daylight, and mostly when we see the exterior of the house or of the setting, it's just foggy and it's misty and you can't really see, and it reminds me of a Charles Bukowski quote where he was asked what love is, and he said, "Love is the fog that burns with the first daylight of reality." And putting the context of that quote into this film, aside from this being about the dark parts of the male psyche, to me, when I watch it, this film boils down to the purest form of love that I've seen on film, and how much these four people love each other, and it's a love that's unbinding. And, you know, if the fog is a physical manifestation of their love for each other, this fog never burns. The only time we see daylight really is in the first act, when they all go, you know, surfing or skinny dipping together in the ocean and they're having a good time before the partying actually ensues. And I mean, these guys, it's the love is overwhelming from the four of them, and then in the second half the three of them, and it's so powerful and it's so engaging. And you know, the soundtrack to this film is amazing. I own the soundtrack. It's made up of predominantly songs from the 80s to early 90s. There's a few that slip through. Obviously, the title of the film is taken from Modern English's song I Melt With You, which Modern English actually re-recorded and did a new rendition of for this film that plays over the end credits, which is fantastic. I love it. I love the original song from the 80s. I love the new rendition of the song that plays over the closing credits. And the title and song of the film is a perfect mesh, and the song completely coincides with what we see happen on the film, because essentially what happens with these guys is they stop the world and they melt with each other, and it's truly beautiful. It's probably one of the most, you know, sans something like Sophie's Choice or The Deer Hunter, it's one of the most tragic things I've ever seen, and it's completely beautiful. So yeah, I mean, I just wanted to step back a minute and talk about the, how I believe this film's about love. And I know you and I have spoken about this, before we wrote our reviews for the film and we shared with it, but that's how I looked at it. I looked at it as this film is the like purest form of love, that there's no gender or sexual connotation with it. It's just this bond that can never be broken, and it's not easily achieved with someone.
Yeah, it's male relationships are very interesting, and this movie touches on a lot of the intricacies of long-term male friendship and what it means to be there for a friend. And It's just such a unique movie because, you know, obviously it's independent. It had to have been independent. There's nothing.
Yeah, right.
There's nothing marketable about this movie. You know, quote unquote. You know, it's not trailer ready. You know, with like a Transformers movie or something. And what I really find interesting is that this movie, you wouldn't make this movie. You wouldn't have this film to say if you didn't mean it, and you wouldn't go down this road if you didn't feel like you had to make this film. And Pellington has been a very interesting director in the sense that his career has just been so eclectic. He's, you know, Arlington Road and The Mothman Prophecies are still, I mean, he banged those movies out in 1999 and 2002 respectively. And that, you know, I mean, in filmmaking terms, that's like, you know, ages ago. And here's a guy who made two great thrillers on the studio level, with more personality than your average studio thriller. I know you've seen Arlington Road. You've seen The Mothman Prophecies.
Right. Yeah. I've seen them both. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they're both terrific. Good. Arlington Road is one of my favorite. I mean, I think it's a modern Parallax View. I think it's a masterpiece personally. The Mothman Prophecies is still one of the creepiest, you know, scary movies that's been made in forever. But then after he has, you know, critical and some box office success with those films, you know, to more of a degree with The Mothman Prophecies on the box office side, it takes him, I think, 6 years to do another feature. In between, there's TV work, there's a concert film for U2, there's some documentaries. And I know, unfortunately, and rather sadly, he did experience the loss of his wife, which I would only have to sort of assume was, you know, some of that. You know, again, I can only assume that I don't know the man, but when something happens like that to you, it must take something out of you, and it must mean something to you personally. And I can't help but feel that an event like that probably informed certain aspects of the story being told. And I know that, you know, Glenn, you know, was a porter. He's the credited writer. Wouldn't be shocked to find out that, you know, Pellington had a lot of input, you know, on the story and some of the themes. It just feels like a film that you would only make if you absolutely had to make it.
Exactly. This is a film that he made for himself.
Which I mean, love. And for me, those are always the best movies for me, the most important ones. And, you know, getting back to the Rotten Tomatoes thing, it's miserable, the idea that, you know, that you could be passing along somehow through Rotten Tomatoes and maybe come across I Melt With You and see 12%. And then most people are just going to be like, oh, fuck this. Like, it's not a good movie. And it's just, you know, some of my absolute favorite movies get killed and get terrible Rotten Tomatoes scores. And it's a shame.
Yeah. It's just the movie got completely sandbagged because there's never been a movie like this. And as you said, this is a completely, personal film.
Our buddy Paul Rowlands made a very astute comment. He likened it to Fight Club meets John Cassavetes.
That's perfect. I mean, and
I think that's an extremely smart comment. And, you know,
right.
I couldn't help but feel about Fight Club.
I was trying to come up with like an analogy on my own like that because that was so perfect. And the only other thing I could come up with would be like, this is Lord of the Flies meets Husbands.
Yeah,
Cassavetes' Husbands. You know what I mean? You know, it'll be interesting because I know a lot of people who listen to our podcast have told both of us that, hey, I'm going to watch this movie tonight, or I'm looking forward to this. There's a few people, Josh in particular, loves this film. I know Marco Train said he was going to watch it tonight, which I think was yesterday. And when this gets posted, I'm very interested to hear what people's reactions are that have never seen this film and are watching this for the first time. You know, I think that most people will have different reactions to this as you get older. I think this movie will affect older people, men, differently than it'll affect, you know, somebody who's 18 and watching this. Wouldn't you think? I mean, I'm 30.
Yeah.
And I have more love for this film now than I did when I initially saw it. And I can't help but feel as I get older and maybe even reach the same age as the characters are in this film, how I'm going to feel about it then.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it when it first came out on VOD, and I have to be honest with you, the impact, it didn't make as big of an impact on me. I like the film, but it didn't register with me the way that it did when I just recently watched it last week. And given that it is only, 4 years old, and I haven't seen it like I've seen something like Fight Club, but I can remember when I saw Fight Club in 1999 in the theater. And throughout the last now, 50, that movie's 16 years old now, right?
Right.
Throughout the last 16 years, I must have watched that movie 10 or 15 times. And that movie is one of those films that means something different every time that you watch it as you get older. This movie will certainly be that way. I'm going to experience I Melt With You, in my 30s, not when I was, in my early 20s and having that sort of progression. But yeah, it's a movie that you will grow with and that will grow with you if you watch it multiple times. It has the potential and possibility to mean something different every time that you watch it, if you separate your viewings. So yeah, and then that to me, that's the richest type of cinema. That's the kind of movies that I'm going to watch consistently over and over again. This is a tough movie to watch. I'm not going to lie and say that I'm going to cue this one up all the time. This is a draining film. Knowing what happens at the end, part of the tension is relieved by knowing what's coming. But this will be a movie where I think that a lot of people maybe once will be enough, just because it's sad. It's a movie that lives in movie world, but at the same time, and I say that just because of just the whole presentation of it, just, you know, how obviously filmic it looks and how gorgeous it is and how, deliberate, how stylish things are. It's a movie. It's it wasn't made with a documentary aesthetic, for instance. But it's a film that is going to, I think we said, it's going to provoke some sort of an immediate response from people because of how intense it is. And the performances they all complement one another. They're all perfectly in sync. Christian McKay, he was an actor I'd never seen before until this film. Unless I've seen him in something and he didn't register with me, and I should have looked on the IMDb before we, really studied his IMDb, but he was just quietly heartbreaking. I mean, the whole thing with him is just like, oh man, really? Like, it's a movie that I think that it will drain people by the end of it. Most people, cinephiles, movie buffs, guys like, you and me, we can watch a movie every day or two movies a day. That's one thing, but this is going to be a challenging piece for a lot of people. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. To wrap up the draining segment of a draining movie, I think the camaraderie and the chemistry of Jane, Lowe, Piven, and McKay is paramount. And I can't think of many ensembles that are firing on all cylinders to the best of their performances, as well as giving a complex and emotionally draining performance. I mean, when rewatching this, I can't even believe that Rob Lowe's in this movie, because I don't know how much people know about Rob Lowe, but 20 years ago he was an addict and he was in terrible shape and he was into drugs and alcohol way beyond belief, and he pulled himself out of it and reinvented himself, and he's been sober ever since then. And when you look at his character in the film, he's the supplier of the drugs, and he may be the hardest user of them all. I mean,
yeah,
I don't want to
Robert Jr.
I don't want to spoil anything, and I'm not going to get into it, but the scene where he shoots himself up and he's just sitting in the chair in his bedroom, and you know, he's looking out the window, and then the image of his past flashes up, and he's watching himself and his then wife and then child on the beach. I mean, it's incredible, and it's just the performances that are in this film is unlike anything I think I've seen. The only other thing I can think of that comes to mind is Glengarry Glen Ross, with an ensemble that is just truly breathtaking. But this film is made. It's sinks or swims on the performances of these characters, or of these actors, I should say. It's the entire film is the daring and naked performances that they give. Soul bearing. It's truly soul bearing. These four actors are just unbelievable.
I still can't see Piven as anything but Ari Gold, and I think that works, funnily enough, in this movie, because while he's not playing an agent, he's definitely playing someone who's very successful, very, you know, quote unquote, sure of himself until you find out what his secret is, which I won't say.
Right.
But it does feel like at times like you were sort of watching Ari Gold get his comeuppance. And I thought that was kind of a sly casting decision on the part of Pellington and, you know, his producers and everybody working with him and who made that decision that, you know, we would bring the Ari Gold baggage in with us, you know, whenever we see a fast talking Piven snorting cocaine and, you know, being a party animal and stuff. So it like you said, the cast was this movie, like you said, sank or swim on the performances of all four and the camaraderie and the chemistry. And I don't think that anybody could say that this movie doesn't have those things in space, you know, in a heaping supply. It's a challenging film. It's a movie that will rub some people the wrong way, will rub some people really, really the right way. And it's impossible not to have a heated response about it, which would have to have been their goal and their intention.
Oh, without a doubt. All right, well, let's...
Yeah.
Well, let's segue into our top five performances. And I know we didn't talk about her when we spoke about the film. Carla Gugino is in this film as the sheriff of the town that they're in. And she isn't in the film a whole lot, but when she's in it, it's important. And most of her screen time is spent with Thomas Jane. And I know we spoke about her character, and you know, I think it's important to have her character in the film because she's the only female that's in the film. And she's a strong female, a good female, not like the ones that are being referred to by the main characters. But also, I think that she observes the characters and sees through them as to what they really are. I think it's a way of Pellington saying how perceptive women are and how they can see through the facade that men put up. And they can see who they really are. So I just wanted to get that out of the way because she's one of our top fives of the week, and we didn't speak about her at all when we spoke about the film. So yeah, she's in the film. She's excellent in it. So yeah.
You want to lead off with your top five for her?
Yeah, I'll do my Gugino top five. My number five is Sucker Punch. Loved her in Sucker Punch. She's a Zack Snyder girl. She's in Man of Steel. She's a voice act in Man of Steel. She's in Watchmen in Sucker Punch. She's wickedly good, and she is, aside from Scott Glenn, the only sympathetic character in the film Sucker Punch, which I absolutely love, which is another film that I know most people don't like, and I know you like it.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I think it's really cool. The more I see it, too, and the more I think about it, the more I like it.
Okay. And my number four is the first thing I ever saw her in, Sin City. She is, what, she was naked in Elijah Wood's dungeon with her hand taken off, and she was completely naked. And She was Mickey Rourke's parole officer, right? That's who she was?
Yeah, it's a massive I-don't-give-a-shit performance.
Right. I mean, she's naked, and she just doesn't give a fuck. It's awesome. Love her in Sin City. That's the first thing I saw her in. She's great. My number three is she was in season four of Californication, and she plays the lawyer Abby Rhodes. And I love the name, because, of course, if Carla Gugino is going to be in Californication as David Duchovny's hot lawyer who's defending him on statutory rape charges, her name is going to be Abby Rhodes. I mean, she's awesome in it. I love her character arc in it. She's fun. She's a good love interest for Duchovny's Hank Moody. I love her in it. It's one of my favorite things. She's one of my favorite characters in the show, I'll say. My number two is I Melt With You. She's brilliant in the film. She isn't the sexy character. She's not the, like how she normally is. Sucker Punch, Sin City, Californication. Mostly everything she's been in, her character has oozes sex appeal. And that's what her character is, a sex appeal, you know, with her nudity and almost everything she's been in. And I Melt With You, she's stripped down. She doesn't really have makeup on. She is just the good woman, the good cop, the good character that tries to prevent the outcome of the film. Yet she sympathizes with what's happening. It's a complex role, and I think it's made more complex than it was originally envisioned. And then my number one for Gugino is Watchmen. Silk Spectre. I mean, what am I going to say? That character is fantastic, along with the rest of the film. And that was the first film I saw her in that truly made me love her as an actress. I think she's fantastic. So that's my top five. Lay it on me.
Right. My number five is her performance on Californication. She was a perfect match for Duchovny, and she had a lot of fun. And, just obviously it's just a super sexy lady. She's just very photogenic. You're never going to go wrong. Number four was her arc on Entourage. She was awesome there. Again, very sexy. Playing Vinny Chase's agent for a spell. Did you watch Entourage?
I saw the first four seasons, but I need to finish it because yep. I know the movie's coming out this year. But, I mean, I loved it.
I was obsessed.
I loved the show. I loved it. It was so outrageous. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe what was happening. But it's just the classic case of I was binge-watching it, and then something else came along that derailed me. But I need to finish it. I loved it.
Yeah, big fan of that show overall, and she was great on it. My number three is in Brian De Palma's Snake Eyes. She has a pretty integral part in that film, and that was the first time that I had ever seen her. That was, 1997 or 98?
Right. Snake Eyes is awesome.
Yeah, love Snake Eyes. Always have, always will, even with the compromised ending. Number two, Watchmen. Just playing I loved Watchmen. It was a fantastic deconstruction of the superhero world and the notion of the real world superhero. And I thought she was great. She was battered and bruised and broken down and vulnerable and intense and sexy and just big fan of her in that film and that movie in general. Maybe one day we'll do a Watchmen podcast because I know that's a divisively received film, and I was a huge fan. And my number one, without a doubt, would be the film that she made in 2009. It came out. It's called Women in Trouble. And I'm not sure if you've ever seen this movie.
I have not.
You have not. Okay. Big recommendation here. It plays like a light version of a Pedro Almodovar movie. This is a movie where she plays a porn star. This is directed by, I believe, her husband. I could be wrong, but I want to say that it's her husband, Sebastian Gutierrez. Carla Gugino, Adrian Palicki, Marley Shelton, Connie Britton, Emmanuel Shariki, another girl from Entourage. This is a movie that was shot in like, you know, 10 or 12 days or something like that. It's one of those movies that takes place in LA, you know, five or six women are, you know, their characters are intertwined over a 24-hour period. And she plays a porn star who finds out that she's pregnant. And when she's headed to the doctor, she gets stuck in an elevator with Connie Britton from Friday Night Lights, who I love. And you just kind of have to see it. It's Joseph Gordon-Levitt has a very small, funny part in it. It's a wild comedy. It's very sexy. There is just a bevy of beautiful women in their bra and underwear.
I'm sold.
Have you ever heard of it? Have you ever heard of this movie?
Yeah, I have. Did her character get a spinoff film or a short film?
Yep, they made another film. Like, her name in the movie is Electra Lux. Yeah,
right.
And I gather that there was a sequel made called Electra Lux, which I have not seen. I'm actually looking it up right now. Carlo Gugino, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Timothy Olyphant, Julianne Moore, and Justin Kirk.
That's a nice cast.
So, and then there's a third. There's a third film that is in the planning stages. The second one is Electra Lux. The third one is apparently being called Women in Ecstasy. And here's a film, 29% at Rotten Tomatoes. I'm not going to go out and say that Women in Trouble is the greatest movie I've ever seen, but it doesn't deserve to have a 29% at Rotten Tomatoes. And it's yet another indication of just people either having an agenda, not getting what it is that they're watching, and then just pooping all over something that is actually fun and has some merit. So my number one, Women in Trouble, seek it out if you've never seen it. It's excellent.
Yeah, I'm going to watch both of them now. That'll be something for me to do next week.
Yep.
All right. Into getting into our top five, Rob Lowe. I've always loved Rob Lowe. I think he's a fantastic comedic actor. I've loved him in everything I've seen him in. I love Rob Lowe. My number five for Rob Lowe is Tommy Boy. His uncredited turn as the shitty stepbrother to Chris Farley. He's just great in that. He's over the top diabolical, and I think he's hilarious. My number four is the sequel to Austin Powers, where he plays the younger version of Robert Wagner. I think he's unbelievable. And I never get tired of the young number two in the sequel to Austin Powers. I think he's hilarious. My number three is his character in the first five seasons of The West Wing, Sam Seaborn, who is the head speech writer for the president of the show. Martin Sheen, he's the young idealist. He instills hope in everyone that he affects in the show. He's very good at delivering the quick Sorkin banter, and he actually departed the show when Sorkin did in the fifth season. But he comes back in the last couple episodes of the series. My number two is Thank You for Smoking. He has a brief role in that film. I think that film is genius in itself. I love all the actors that have the extended cameos, and Sam Elliott as the Marlboro Man dying of cancer is a standout. And I particularly love Rob Lowe as the Hollywood executive that's telling Aaron Eckhart, who's the lobbyist for Big Tobacco, that we can't smoke in movies anymore. I think it's hilarious. My number one is a tie. I had a couple of ties here for Rob Lowe, and I figured I could only do one tie. So my tie for number one is his best dramatic performance in I Melt With You as Jonathan. I've touched upon it many times earlier, how heartbreaking and just beautifully tragic he is. And then my other one is his role in Californication, where he plays the insane method actor Eddie Nero, who plays Hank Moody in a film in the fourth season, and then in season 5, 6, and 7 has episodes where he comes back in. He's outrageous. He's the most outrageous thing I've ever seen. in a TV show. He is completely out of control. And I remember in the fifth season when he came back in an episode, back when I used Twitter, I remember I tweeted Rob Lowe, and I said, Eddie Nero's back. You are tied with Daniel Day-Lewis as the best actor that's ever lived. And he tweeted me back, and he said, ha, 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 exclamation point, that's funny. And that was a highlight of my life, because I got a tweet back from Rob Lowe. I'm just throwing that out there. I've had Twitter exchanges with people, but that's one of the best I've ever had. The fact that Rob Lowe read my tweet and tweeted me back made my life. So I like the connection of Gugino and Lowe in Californication. They have an episode together that I think is the episode before the finale of season four. Californication, as you know, and some people who listen to the show, is my favorite television show of all time, and I often compare my life as a shitty, watered-down broadcast version of Californication. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
The NBC all right, man. Version.
Yeah, my life's like the CBS version of Californication. It's not even the NBC version, because NBC has good shows. I'm the ABC or CBS version of Californication. But anyway, please, let me hear your top five, Rob Lowe.
My number five is Thank You for Smoking. His part there was absolutely hysterical. Adam Brody playing his put-upon assistant, also hysterical in tandem with him. But yeah, just the whole thing, you can't smoke in movies, just kills it. You know, just he's one of those guys who has the ability to come in and just nail something very quickly. Number four, because I watched it when I was younger a lot, because I was a hockey player. Youngblood, not the greatest movie, maybe not his greatest performance, but when I was a kid, it was the only hockey movie that was around, except for Slapshot. And Youngblood was a movie that I used to watch with my hockey players, all my, you know, when I was in, like, you know, the peewees and, you know, high school and all that kind of stuff. Youngblood made a big impression on me because I loved hockey. Number three is his work in Californication. Absolutely over the top, hysterical, just completely just hypersexualized and totally vulgar and completely
just the most outrageous thing
outrageous
I've ever seen.
And awkward and crazy. Number two is going to be I'm Out With You. Definitely going to some dramatic places that I never really thought that he was capable of doing. And really just, you know, providing a major anchor for that film. And number one for me, without a doubt, whenever I think of Rob Lowe, I think of his role in Wayne's World. I just can't, that, to me, because I watched that movie so much when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. He'll always be for me, the antagonist of Wayne's World, and that smarmy guy with that smile and, walking like he had, you know, had a pole shoved up him at the end. And I'll never not think about that, but I'll also throw out some love too for the West Wing, his work there with the, you know, the episodes that I saw. He was also awesome in The Stand, that miniseries back in the mid.
Yeah,
he was great.
As the mute.
And I will admit to one thing. I've only seen it once, and I have next to no memory, but I should revisit The Outsiders.
Yep.
I really don't have much of a memory of that at all. So
The Outsiders, St. Elmo's Fire, and then he was in a film called Class with Andrew McCarthy and Jacqueline Bisset, where Andrew McCarthy and Rob Lowe were roommates at a boarding school. And Andrew McCarthy was like the nerdy kid that got made fun of, and he ends up having this relationship with Jacqueline Bisset, who turns out to be Rob Lowe's mom. I haven't seen that movie in probably 20 years, but I remember,
I
think I was way too young. It's good from what I remember. I'd watch it again. I think Cliff Robertson plays Rob Lowe's dad and Jacqueline Bisset's husband, so it's got a nice little cast there. The funny thing is I haven't seen Youngblood, and I was talking to one of my buddies about my Rob Lowe top five this morning, and he's like, you seen Youngblood? And I'm like, I've never heard of it. He's like, it is terrible, but you have to see it because it's amazing.
Yeah, it's not very, it's not a good movie at all. In fact, I'm almost positive that it was like a low budget Canadian production, and it was something that, it was just something that was just so cheesy. But again, when you're 8 years old and you play hockey, that's right. Patrick Swayze is in it too. That's right. How could I forget? it's not a great movie, but if you're a completist, it's worth checking out. So, and that's right. Keanu Reeves is in the movie. It's his like first or second film appearance. It's like,
and aren't they all in Outsiders too? I know Swayze is, and Rob Lowe is. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Keanu Reeves.
I don't know about Reeves. I don't remember much at all about the Outsiders. But the Youngblood is a really cheesy 80s movie, but it has its moments. It's probably the only reason why it has its moments is because there's some sort of nostalgia factor. But what did you get? What did you get caught up with over the week? Anything memorable that you watched?
Just Goodfellas and I'm Out With You is pretty much all I watched. I got caught up on Game of Thrones, and I still have an episode or two to catch up on Mad Men. I haven't had a chance
to... We'll get into Mad Men in the next couple weeks, obviously, with the last two episodes on the horizon. Been absolutely incredible. You know what I've noticed? Robert Towne has been working on this last season. Have you noticed his name in the credits as a consultant?
I haven't.
Yeah,
are you serious?
Yeah, Robert Towne has been listed in the whole final season as a consulting producer. So
interesting.
He's been like sitting in the writer's room with them, I guess, and hawking ideas around, which is just cool to even think about Robert Towne.
Smoking his cigarettes and telling all the writers that he fucking wrote Chinatown and all this other shit. This is what you gotta do, kid.
Yeah, over the week I saw a movie called Miami Blues, which is something I had never seen, from 1990 with Alec Baldwin and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
God, I own that on VHS.
Yeah, sort of fell in between the cracks when it came out. Didn't do very well in the box office, and not hard to see why. Sort of a pre-Tarantino mixing comedy and violence. Alec Baldwin giving a really interesting, funny performance. So that's one for people to catch up with if they haven't seen it or if it snuck by them. It's a good little movie from the director of Gross Point Blank. It's a good one to get caught up with. That was fun. I revisited one of my favorite movies of all time, Blow Up. I'll never not love that movie. It's just one of the sexiest, one of the coolest movies I've ever made. And that's another movie where you watch that film. If you scatter your viewings throughout the years, it'll mean something different every time you see it. Watching it last week was wonderful. Just a great film, and just so inherently cinematic and exciting and mysterious and, above all, just so cool. So I love that film. Got a chance to see that again. And trying to think about anything else notable. Oh, I would have to say, I won't get into it too much, but I've just learned from a Facebook friend, Ryan Marshall. He put these films of Duke Mitchell, this Gone with the Pope and Massacre Mafia style, these lost and found 70s exploitation films. I watched Gone with the Pope last night. It was an absolute, just an incredibly funny thing, just a relic of a time and of a style of filmmaking that I'm not too familiar with overall, but man, just very funny and entertaining and wild and crazy. And
I will say I'm buying both of those films this week.
Oh, yeah, they're
after watching the trailer and talking to you about it.
Incessantly throughout the day. So, yeah, so that's pretty much where I'm at. And, next weekend we are we'll do our, sick show, which will be fun. And we're going to be spotlighting a movie that I think really, really snuck through, the public consciousness. And that would be Jean-Pierre Jeunet's Very Long Engagement. This is the guy who directed City of Lost Children, Amelie, Delicatessen, Alien Resurrection, Micmacs. He's a newer film that just came out last year. I can't remember the title. But A Very Long Engagement, I think, is a masterpiece, and I think it's going to be... you haven't seen it, correct?
Correct. I am looking forward to watching it.
I think you'll be blown away. It's a very intense, really, really intense film. So I can't wait to get into that next week. And we're also going to spotlight top five performances. We're going to go with Colin Farrell, who's one of my favorite actors. We'll do top five performances for him. He's not involved with a very long engagement, but Jodie Foster has a supporting part in a very long engagement. So we're going to go with Jodie Foster for top five performances from her. So, and we'll also have a big discussion at the front end on George Miller's Fury Road, Mad Max Fury Road, which opens next weekend. And both Frank and I will be seeing it before we record. So we'll have our discussion for that. I know I am absolutely beyond thrilled to see it.
I am right there with you. I can't even wait to see it. I got even more excited when I saw the red carpet premiere and Mel Gibson showed up at the red carpet premiere. So
yeah, that was cool. Seeing him with Tom Hardy. Very cool.
I am looking forward to that so much. And like I said at the top of the show, I can't even believe this is our fifth episode. It's amazing. We both absolutely love doing this, and I've met so many people that I'm now Facebook friends with through doing this podcast, and it has brought the meaning of Facebook to a new level to me, where I can go on it multiple times a day and discuss film with you and all sorts of other people who I've met through doing this, and I absolutely love it, and I couldn't be happier where I am right now, and this is just fantastic, and I love doing this, and thank you and everybody who's listening to this. It's truly great.
Yeah, the sentiment is the same, man. It's been a lot of fun, a lot of great people talking to online and getting a chance to find out about a lot of movies that I never, ever, ever, ever would have thought about or known about or given any credence to. So it's been a lot of fun, and thank you everybody for listening, and hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed doing it, and we'll look forward to more.
Right on. We'll catch you guys next week, and hopefully everybody has a happy Mother's Day and tells their mothers about our awesome podcast.
Yes, happy Mother's Day, everybody.